Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. In this hour, we're going to examine why blue-collar jobs in America don't get much respect for the level of intelligence that's required to do them and why that needs to change. My guests today all have a connection to this part of the labor force in one way or another. We have UCLA professor Mike Rose, who is the author of a book called The Mind at Work, in which he systematically looks at the use of skills like math, psychology, and creativity in jobs ranging from waitressing to building cars. Professor Blaine Waldron is supervisor of adult and community education for Columbus City Schools. And Carol Higgins is coordinator of the OTAP program, that's Orientation to Trade and Apprenticeship Program, at Columbus State Community College. And thank you all for joining us on Open Line. Professor Rose, let's start with you. You come from a blue-collar family, and that was like a laboratory that prepared you for your extensive study of what it really takes to do a number of blue-collar jobs. Explain what it was that you observed early in life that made you want to later on take a closer look.
Well, thanks for calling it a laboratory, Charlene. I think that's a nice metaphor. As you say, I grew up watching folks do blue-collar work and service work. My mother was a career waitress. My uncles worked for the railroad and the auto industry. They were machinists and welders. So this is the kind of work that I knew growing up, and it's the kind of work that made my life possible.
How did you feel about your family being in those lines of work?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I think I came to understand a lot about what that meant socially later in my life. In the middle of it, all I knew was that, you know, there were times when things were hard, people got laid off. You could certainly feel the difficulty and the tension in the house. But what I also saw was just competence surrounding me. I mean, I'd go watch my mother at work, and I was fascinated by how she could navigate that restaurant, or when my uncles would take me to see what they did. What I saw was competence and ability, and that's what I was taken with.
Let's talk to Blaine now for a moment. You handle adult and community education for Columbus Public Schools. What kinds of occupations are you preparing your students for?
Well, a lot of the blue-collar work jobs, heating, ventilating, and air conditioning, commonly referred to as HVAC, auto mechanics, nurse aide training, nursing, office systems skills, computer skills, word processing, spreadsheets, databases, things like that.
And how do your students feel about their future in these kinds of jobs? I guess it would be in comparison with, say, students that are going to law school. They know they're going to be in a prestigious job. What do your students feel about their future in these jobs?
Well, I think they're very excited about their jobs and their career opportunities. Many of them have come from a background area where they do not have family members that went on to college. They themselves were blue-collar workers, so therefore they're excited about the opportunity to work in a chosen profession, and they're very energetic, I might add, in the classroom.
And, Carol, what are you seeing at Columbus State in terms of attitudes about these jobs and the numbers of people who are seeking this kind of employment through OTAP?
Well, through the years, I've seen a big change. I think, of course, being a woman in the trades, we've introduced women to many jobs that perhaps they would have thought weren't something they could do. You know, there's 408 different classifications of jobs within the trades, and our biggest message that we give to all of our students is you can do the job that you choose, choose the career that gives you passion, something that you enjoy, and it's not based on your gender, it's not based on your age, it's not based on anything like that, it's based on the abilities that you can do that you obtain.
I'm sorry, what are some of the occupations that women are going into that maybe are considered non-traditional?
Well, actually, I'm a carpenter. So that's a non-traditional job. When I first started, there were very few carpenters that were female. My daddy was a builder. He was a minister and built churches and other buildings, and I loved to do that. Even though I learned to sew and learned to do all the things that, quote, women do, When I was growing up, I really, really loved to build with my hands. So personally, myself, that's a trade that is getting much more open to women. All of the trades are. It's still very difficult. It's a lot of hard work. Not all trades are designed where women can do them. For example, I don't think I could actually be an iron worker because the work is too heavy for me. So we know our limits, but we also know that we're based on our abilities. We should be able to do whatever job we want to do in the trades.
And Mike, in fact, carpentry is one of the occupations that you looked at. Talk about some of the skills that are involved in that trade that we don't even think about, that we don't give credit for.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, Carol could probably speak to this better than I, but certainly what I saw as I looked very closely at this work was all the problem-solving and troubleshooting involved, certainly the mathematical skills involved. As young people become more and more proficient at woodworking and carpentry, they build a knowledge base, and that knowledge base becomes quite sophisticated as they gain expertise. And they use that knowledge base to solve problems. There are all kinds of aesthetic concerns depending on the kind of work they do. So they develop a whole set of aesthetic values about what looks good and what doesn't, and functionally what you have to do to make something look good as well as work well. So there's a whole range of cognitive skills that get developed that are the kind of skills that we, interestingly enough, that we hear these days are so important for the new economy. It's nothing new to carpentry. I mean, these folks have been utilizing these kinds of skills for some time.
And Carol, as a carpenter, can you expand on what Mike just said?
Well, absolutely. I think paying attention to the detail, making it not only safe to use and workable, but look good. I find many women, and many times when I talk to employers, they hire women for that very reason. They pay attention to all of the fine detail, making it beautiful in every way that they possibly can, using their skills. Obviously, the math. I remember when I first started, and I learned how to put roofs over a deck. I didn't know Pythagorean theorem, didn't really have any idea what it was, although I was using it every day when I got in the teaching part of the program and teaching OTAP and in the math classes. I was like, oh, well, that's something that I've been doing for a really long time. Learned from the old guys with string and tape measures. Learned from the young kids how to do it mathematically. Uh-huh. So much easier, so much quicker to get the job done.
Blaine, can you comment from your program on some of those kinds of skills, intellectual skills, math or drawing or those kinds of things that your students have to use mm-hmm. every day?
Well, I think one of the foundations behind a lot of this is the ability to think through problems and problem solving. They have to be able to do that because not everything that is drawn up is 100% correct and doable in the field. So there's a lot of problem solving and reasoning skills that go into fields like carpentry and masonry and heating, ventilating, air conditioning, where they have to think for themselves and figure it out as they go along.
Mike, you talk a lot about your uncle who worked in the auto industry and the things he had to learn and use on the job. Talk about some of those things, because there's a whole range of skills that he put into practice in his career.
Right. And what's important to remember about him is that he came from a generation where it was not unusual that he dropped out in the ninth grade to go to work. So this was a man without even a high school education. And what he was fond of saying was that that General Motors became his classroom. He started mm-hmm. off on the line and worked hard, made his way up to foreman and then supervisor. And as he would talk to me about this work, I would see exactly the kind of not only problem solving, but finding problems. That is, for example, noticing that the way paint is applied in a certain way, the way paint is applied is really inefficient. There's a lot of overspray. It's harmful to the sprayers, and it's also wasteful. And so he came up with an idea about a different kind of nozzle, talked to a machinist, got that nozzle made, and it ended up saving money for the company and being more helpful for the people people doing the work. So it's that kind of thing that I would hear him talk about, not just solving a problem, but finding the problem to be solved.
Why is the intellectual side of this kind of work given such short shrift? When did we start to feel like this was not these were not professions to be admired? Mike?
Well, you know, unfortunately, Charlene, it goes way back to the early days of the Republic. I mean, when I was doing the research for The Mind at Work, I kept running across things from, you know, the 18th century in this country where mechanics, for example, were considered to be illiterate and not even fit to vote. So we, unfortunately, in this wonderfully democratic nation, have this kind of aristocratic, elitist streak about the kinds of jobs we're talking about. And that, of course, has been cranked up in our own time as we've become enamored, and rightly so, enamored of all the quote-unquote new economy kinds of jobs. But the sad thing is that we end up making this big dichotomy, this split, thinking that, oh, well, all the brains go into the white-collar new economy jobs and all the other stuff, that doesn't require any thought at all. So it goes back a long way, and I think it's amped up in our time.
Blaine, your training programs actually kind of straddle what Mike is talking about, where some of it is the manual type of work, but some of it is also directed towards this knowledge economy and working with computers and that kind of thing. Do you have to fight against attitudes that look down on those kinds of jobs, the manual labor kinds of jobs, as you train your students?
Well, I don't know if we have to fight against the attitudes with our students, because many of our students come in with an open mind and are excited about learning that skill. I think there is the perception out there in the public that, as an example, HVAC technician, somebody that works in heating and air conditioning systems, is not an educated person. And yet, when you get into some of the things that they have to know, you know, with airflow and electronics and things like that to troubleshoot a furnace system, that right there demands higher skills and academic abilities. So there is the perception out there in the public often, but I don't think there's such a big perception with our students.
Does that public perception, Carol, create problems with your students getting jobs, or create problems with how they feel about their work?
Well, I think absolutely can. We try to I call them myth busters. We try to take care of those problems, because without the trades, without the people, the blue-collar workers, we wouldn't have anything in this country. I mean, the stuff that's made is made by hand. You know, you can ship a lot of things overseas, but you can't ship a house from overseas to be built here. You know, we have construction. We build our highways. We do all these things. And as you were saying, Blaine, that the chemistry even involved, even in cement masonry and concrete work and all this stuff, there's so much more, you know, math or chemistry involved in electricity. You know, you have to have a lot of algebra and be able to do these. Now, for women, I think it even adds a second tier to that, because it becomes, well, you know, a woman in the trades, why are you doing that? I was so excited when I started reading your book, Mike, because your mother's name was Rosie, and of course Rosie the Riveter is someone who we're very fond of in the trades. But it proved a fact that transferable skills are there, and people can do jobs, again, based on their knowledge. We would be sad without the blue-collar workers. We wouldn't have things to drive. We wouldn't have kitchens to eat out of. We wouldn't have food to eat. I mean, there's just so many things that wouldn't happen if everybody, and I say this even coming from a college, if everybody had that four-year or master's degree jobs, life would still be really boring without everyone who provides the services.
Yeah, we'd be short of a whole lot of goods and services, you know, without the people who do the blue-collar jobs.
That's right.
We're talking with UCLA Professor Mike Rose, who is author of a book called The Mind at Work, looking at the intelligence of the American worker in blue-collar jobs. We also have Professor Blaine Waldron, who is with Adult and Community Education for Columbus City Schools. He is Supervisor of Adult and Community Education. And Carol Higgins is Coordinator of the OTAP program at Columbus State Community College. which prepares students for trades and apprenticeship programs. We'd love to have you join the conversation with your questions and your comments. You can call us at 292-8513 or send an email to openline@wosu.org. Mike, what Carol said kind of leads to the question, too. Have we gotten too far away from understanding that we need people who know how to make things and who understand all of the more labor-intensive aspects of our economy?
Well, I think we get far away from it until the plumbing backs up, mm-hmm. right? Then suddenly everybody's very, very much aware of how much we need this whole wide range of work. But I think, too, and I'd be interested to see what the other folks think about this, I think, too, that the events of the last 5 or 6 years, this wrenching shift in the economy, has been sobering in this regard, as we've seen that that white-collar, new economy jobs are just as exportable as manufacturing jobs. And some of those securities and assurances that we had about this kind of work have just gone out the window.
Blaine?
Yes, I would agree with that. You know, one of the things that has shocked me about this economy and all the layoffs that have happened in the last year or two is the number of college-educated people, especially in the financial and high-end service areas, that they have lost their jobs, and that's a surprise because. You know, many people think that if you have a college education, you're going to have a job and you're going to be employable. And that is not necessarily true. It is always a help to have a college education, but you still have to have a skill set to go with it.
And Carol?
Absolutely. Even at Columbus State, you know, our enrollment is getting higher and higher because of that very fact. I have students in my program who have been attorneys who are now saying, you know, I need to find another skill that I can do so that I can earn money. And I think we're going back to using our hands. We're going back to using our minds and thinking and building and problem solving and doing the work that needs to be done.
We have some calls on the line now. Let's talk to Harold. Hello, Harold. You're on Open Line.
Hi, good morning. Interesting program. And I appreciate the fact that you're having this conversation.
Thank you.
I'm interested in a couple of things. It's a two-part comment and question. First of all, I'd like for you to discuss apprenticeship programs, non-union and union apprenticeship programs in particular, because they seem to have fallen out of favor. There was a rise and fall of apprenticeship programs. And along with that, about the workforce in general. And what I call mismanagement science, the practice of taking the most skilled workers off of the job and making them essentially straw bosses, non-productive employees in most cases, and really undermining the integrity of the workforce. They did a lot of that in management science in the 70s and 80s until they figured out that, you know, it wasn't helpful they were getting top heavy, and it started to hurt them. But in the meantime, they always seem to stumble over their own shoelaces. And I'd like for you to comment on those two issues. Thank you.
Okay, let's start with Blaine.
Well, you know, one of the difficulties with the apprenticeship programs that I have seen in the past is the length of time necessary to get through the apprenticeship process. The jobs and the careers are very attractive. But often people shy away from the apprenticeship opportunities because of the length of time and commitment that it takes to get through the entire training program.
Give us an example of how long it would take.
I don't have exact numbers on the length of time, but you know, Carol may have more knowledge on that, but they often take several years.
Carol?
Well, the good thing about apprenticeship programs, and I'm a very strong advocate for them, both union and non, is that you automatically have a job and you're earning money while you're learning. A lot of people, again, that's another myth buster that I talk about. A lot of apprenticeships are now paid. If you decide to become an operating engineer, the day you're accepted or indentured into that apprenticeship as a first year apprentice, you're making wages. You have full benefits, you have full insurance, you have a lot of benefits that other jobs would never give you that opportunity. You'd have to have a 90-day probation period or whatever. It is at a lesser pay. It's 50%, but 50% of prevailing wage for an operating engineer might start out around $18 or $19 an hour. So that's not bad, plus all of your benefits, which they pay.
Okay,
on top of that. So it's very good money. Now, you will be, if I use operating engineers, you'll be the one for 4 years and until you become a journeyman. But your pay increases every year and you're trained. And I love the concept of learning with a master, watching them as I'm learning. I was an apprentice as a carpenter. They taught me not just out of a book or watching a movie, but I did it with my hands right there with someone who showed me how. So in that sense, again, I really choose not to get into the union versus non-union kind of training. Our program is to help people get jobs, wherever that may be.
Bottom line. And
bottom
Mike, what about the second half of Harold's question about pulling most skilled people off of doing the job and making them middle managers or, as he put it, straw bosses?
Well, you know, that practice goes back to the early part of the 20th century with the separation of management and the creation of management science and the separation of management from the work itself, this idea that was promulgated and gained great popularity that somehow or another the brains involved in coordinating work is different from the brains involved in doing it. And so you got the kind of separation he's talking about rather than, you know, think of other alternatives that could have developed and in some places do where workers who are highly skilled are increasingly compensated, they have more authority, but they stay in the work, right? There's not this complete separation of the way you organize the work from the doing of the work. So I think he put his finger on something interesting there.
All right. We're going to have to take a little break right here. We're talking to three guests about valuing the intelligence of American workers, blue-collar workers. We're talking to UCLA Professor Mike Rose, who is author of a book called The Mind at Work. We're also talking to Carol Higgins, who's coordinator of the OTAP program at Columbus State Community College, leading to trades and apprenticeships, and to Professor Blaine Waldron, who is supervisor of adult and community education for Columbus City Schools. We'll continue our discussion. You can join in with a call to 292-8513 or an email to openline@wosu.org right after this break. This is WOSU 820 Columbus.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.
Thanks for tuning in to Open Line this morning here on WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich today. Pleasant summer day today. Currently it's 82 degrees, high expected around 87, clear tonight with a low of 65. Scattered thunderstorms throughout the day tomorrow with a high of 78, but the rain and the gray skies are going to be worth it. This weekend should be cool and partly cloudy with a high of 72 on Saturday and 74 on Sunday. Coming up on Fresh Air at noon, the politics of healthcare reform, Congress, the insurance lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby, the AMA. Healthcare author Jonathan Cohn joins the conversation. That's coming up today at noon on Fresh Air here on WOSU 820. NPR News.
Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. We've been discussing the value of intelligence in American workers who do blue-collar jobs, how they are underappreciated, and often their intelligence is underestimated. My guests are Carol Higgins from the OTAP program at Columbus State Community College, Blaine Waldron, supervisor of adult and community education for Columbus City Schools, and UCLA professor Mike Rose, who is author of a book called The Mind at Work, which systematically looks at all the skills and all the intellect that is involved in many different blue-collar jobs. We have some callers on the line, so let's talk to Tom now. Hi, Tom. You're on Open Line.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that it's pretty obvious that blue-collar workers are very smart and are vitally important to society and culture, but the whole notion that they're not goes way back beyond the 1800s. We don't want to talk about class in this country. We like to pretend it doesn't exist, but we like to say we have democracy. But basically the reason that blue-collar people are put down is because the people on top want it that way. Just yesterday I heard on NPR that the notion that they might tax the wealthy to pay for the health care was dead on arrival. The plan that they put out to do that was dead on arrival. Now, that's 10-15% of the people at the top outvoting 85-90% of the people on the bottom. And the reason that, you know, there was somebody I heard years ago on NPR or on WSU say that the most important person in society was the farmer because we couldn't live without eating, and the second most important person was the garbage collector because if he didn't collect the garbage, we'd all die of disease. And so we can talk all we want about how smart blue-collar people are and how valuable they are, but the society is set up to ignore that until we start realizing that there is a class structure here that has a vested interest in keeping people down who aren't like them at the top. We're not going to get anywhere, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you for listening.
All right, Tom, thank you so much for calling. Mike, why don't you start addressing that the comment that Tom has made?
Well, gosh, you know, for a while now, Charlene, I've been writing opinion pieces and whatnot saying that the conversation we need to have in this country is a conversation about social class because, I mean, I think it is the dirty little secret that in this democracy we do have class structure, and it carries with it attitudes as well as power. So I think, you know, with the election of President Obama, he began a conversation about race. I think we also need a conversation about social class.
Carol, do you think that conversation is about to get started since President Obama has offered much more support for community colleges and for vocational training?
I can only hope so. I think it's long overdue. And I think it'll make a great difference in our country. I have to believe that better things are coming.
And his program is called the American Graduation Initiative. It gives $12 billion to community colleges and adds 5 million new graduates by the year 2020 and would offer training to millions of students who can't afford four-year universities and also would give opportunity to older workers who need new skills. And I guess, Blaine, that also plays into your program because you have people coming to your program who need another occupation. They've got to retrain because what they used to do is not there anymore.
That is correct. And one of the areas that we work with a lot of our students on is academic improvement because the blue-collar jobs do require more and more expectations on a person for writing skills, communication skills, math skills, etc. So we work with students in that area. In addition to the actual job skill that is necessary to work in the field.
And Carol?
I so agree because the days of going into a factory and just applying for a job are over. There are many, many tests to take. We have intense math classes within our own OTAP program. We have reading classes. We have academic enrichment programs because you have to have skills. Like I said, you cannot just apply for a job and get it anymore, even in a factory.
Okay, it takes a lot more than it used to. This call is also from a caller named Tom. Hello, Tom. You're on Open Line.
Hi, this is Tom.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention a new book just came out, which is akin to Mike Rose's book, I would think. It's called Shop Class as Soul Craft, an inquiry into the value of work by guy named Matt Crawford. I just read this book, and it's a vindication of my family's vocation for centuries. But I also...
What is your family's vocation, Tom?
Well, my dad was a pipe fitter for TRW in Cleveland for 42 years, and he used his, you know, his physical and mental abilities just about every day, and had a great opportunity to use his creativity and solve problems, you know, as a pipe fitter, high pressure lines and hydraulics and things like that. Of course, it was a huge plant, so he had a lot of territory he could roam in, maintaining it and, you know, adding new systems. But I wanted to also mention that I was really happy when I went to Barnes & Noble to get this book, and I found that it was actually required reading for the Upper Arlington High School for the fall. And I thought that was pretty significant.
And why did you think that was significant?
Well, because it's a subject that everybody needs to learn more about, but it's one that's been neglected. And
were you struck by the fact that it was Upper Arlington that was requiring it?
Well, any high school. I mean, of course, I live in Upper Arlington. It's a great high school, but there was also another book on there called Nickel and Dimed, which is a pretty interesting book by a PhD who talks about blue-collar workers in the service industry, waitresses and so forth. It came out in 2002, and she actually did those kinds of jobs for a year before she wrote the book. So between that book, this book, and Mike Rose's book, that's a trilogy that people need to have right out on the dining room table.
All right, Tom, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
You're welcome.
Certainly, Mike, you've got to be familiar with all of these. In fact, I know you used at least one of them in your book as a reference point.
Right, and Matt Crawford and I have actually become friends through all this.
Uh-huh.
So, I hope that Tom is right. I mean, I hope that, and this actually plays onto the other Tom's comment too, I hope that we are getting to the place where we're going to be thinking about some of these issues again and having some conversations about work and what work takes and the meaning of work and the place of work in our lives and maybe rethinking some of these old distinctions that we've lived with.
Mm-hmm. And by having the conversation, maybe we can start to reshape our thinking and take it to where it really ought to be, because I don't think we can afford, especially given our circumstances now, to underrate or shortchange anyone.
You know, Charlene, in that regard, something here's an example of the kind of commonplace definitions that we've lived with our whole lives that need to be rethought, and that's this basic distinction between something that's academic and something that's vocational.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the whole gist of our conversation over the last 40 minutes has been that so many of the skills that are championed as being quote-unquote academic skills, using knowledge, solving problems, being reflective about what you do, well, gee, lo and behold, when you look closely at all these other kinds of jobs that are, you know, the vocational quote-unquote domain, we see that the very same kinds of mental processes are involved there as well. So that's an example of one of the assurances that I would like to see as question.
And Blaine, can you expand on what Mike just said?
Well, many of the areas, like, let's just say, auto mechanics, there is a considerable amount of hands-on application of knowledge, and also a considerable amount of the academic math skills that go into it. Many fields, you have to be good at communicating with others. So technical report writing, not necessarily in the terms of a formal report, but getting the information across to a coworker or a manager as to what is going on, are all very important communication skills that are being taught in the vocational career tech centers today.
And Carol, how do you go about reshaping the discussion the way Mike has said, getting away from this separation between the intellectual and the vocational?
Actually, I think it needs to start at a much younger age than those that are ready for college. I truly believe that the jobs that are in the trades or the jobs that we're discussing, the service jobs, need to be presented more attractive. It shouldn't be, okay, you go to college or you can do this other stuff. Many of the meetings we've had here recently with the workforce development and some of the big major companies are talking about figuring out a way to make the jobs more attractive, even in, you know, school, junior high school. I can give you an example. My daughter really, really wanted to be, she has a master's in physics, but she wanted to teach physics, But her instructor said, oh, you know, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that because that's not attractive. You want to go on and be the physicist. You want to make big money. Why teach it? Those teachers, that you know, they're just not that important. Go on so you can make big money. She's a teacher, okay, mm-hmm. because she finally decided, even coming to OSU, that, you know, I want to teach. I love what I do. I want girls to get excited about science. I want them to understand it. So she teaches in a very, you know, Granville is a very good school system in Ohio. But it needs to be started at a much younger age in realizing the value of the jobs that service people do.
But it sounds like there also needs to be discussion with people like the physics professor who told your daughter you don't want to teach.
Well,
That, you know, hey, come on.
In high school, isn't it the push to go to college, get that four-year degree? That's the push. That's what we all heard, and we're beginning to realize that's not the only thing that there is to do. There's much, much more. And I coming from a vocational school background, I believe they have made huge differences. When the vocational schools started, you know, I remember when ours first opened, it was in 1974. And, you know, oh my gosh, girls didn't go out there and take shop. That was just not something we could do. Well, yes, we can. And I believe it's getting much, much better, but we still have a long way to go.
All right, let's take another call. This one is from Chris. Hi, Chris. You're on Open Line.
How do you do? This is a great topic. From personal experience, I believe that one thing that should be addressed is the degree to which those who have a great deal of economic power influence the way that that workers are seen and, you know, what they're able to do. I used to be in the home improvement business, and I'm pretty sure that everybody knows that is fraught with all manner of, you know, insufficiency or what have you. But there's a way in which it's ingrained in the system, and even the guys who are very good just accept that as a matter of course. Now, the ultimate problem becomes those who are highly skilled have a more, say, intellectual way of completing jobs, who are more attentive to detail and so on. Those guys are understandably a little, they cost more than other people. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of people in that business who look at this as just a liability. You know, let me use the amateurs who I can pay less money, and as long as the customer doesn't know the difference, everything will be okay. And this is one of the reasons why things like Angie's List and Better Business Bureau are tools that the consumer can use. But even outside of that industry, say not home improvement, you could be talking about anything. You could be talking about an auto mechanic, a car shop, and there are people who are masters at what it is that they do. But again, because they have that knowledge base, they command, say, a higher wage. And there are just a lot of people who own and manage who are not interested in paying that kind of money or in sharing the benefit of a great product or service.
Chris, thank you very much for adding to our discussion. Mike, what Chris just said also made me think about part of the problem perhaps being the appearance of these jobs. A lot of times you get dirty. All of a sudden we don't have any respect or don't have much respect for jobs where you have to get dirty. And everybody wants that's why we call it a white-collar job, because you get to wear a nice, crisp white shirt to work and stay clean all day. Is that part of what has gone on, is just the image?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And again, it goes back a long way in our history and other cultures' histories as well. You're right. The symbol of the white collar is a powerful one. You know, the collar also, Chris, I think it was, brought up a really interesting point, and that is, you know, we've been talking about the social pressures and the beliefs that work against understanding the intelligence and the competence of blue-collar work, but he reminds us, too, that there's all sorts of economic pressures within these occupations that also push against the display of excellence, the rush for the clock. How many people can you get in a day? How many jobs can you get done in a day? And he's right. I mean, skilled craftspeople chafe at the kinds of pressures that they get from the occupation itself. I thought that was a nice point.
Mm-hmm. Very good one. And Blaine, did you want to comment on that too? Because this is one of the things that you and your students have to deal with daily.
Well, yes, I would like to comment on it. The image and also a term that Chris used was amateurs, and those are very important issues there. Many of the occupations and training programs are now going to certification tests, national certification tests or statewide certification tests. And more and more it's becoming necessary for a person to have a certification to work in a field. It may not be something like the nursing board regulating the situation, but it still would be an expectation of the industry and a business. It was mentioned auto mechanics. While there are ASC certifications in that area, and that's Automotive Excellence Certification Tests that people take to prove that they actually know what they're saying they can do. And those are very important issues there. Certification is a very important issue for many of the industries to prevent the amateurs coming in, and I hate to say it, but not providing the quality of service that is expected in the industry.
And Carol, did you want to comment also on that?
Well, absolutely. Even in our educational programs, the standardized materials that we teach all have to now be certified. There has to be certification, whether it's NCCER or it's NERI or it's just
okay,
all of
these
kind of –
Okay, what are all the acronyms?
There's so many, and I shouldn't even start it on all of them, but like NERI is the National Association for the Remodeling Industry. If they put their seal of approval, it's kind of like the Better Business Bureau seal of approval on those who do those home remodeling kind of small companies so that the consumers – sure that they have quality work being done at their home, if it's roofing or it's finishing something. But any kind of training now is going to require more and more certification.
And also on the issue of image, we have an email from Rob. He says, Mike Rowe, host of Discovery Channel's Dirty Jobs, spoke at a TED conference, and I'm not sure what TED is, but spoke at a TED conference about the value of labor or vocational jobs that was really compelling. In that same vein, there are a lot of new TV shows glorifying labor work, like Dirty Jobs, Deadliest Catch, Ice Road Truckers, etc. It also seems like there's a backswing toward labor jobs as the economy is failing. And I think all three of you have in various ways addressed that question that, you know, yeah, we are starting to look more at labor jobs. Carol?
One of the biggest things that we're focusing on now are green construction training and weatherization skills, because besides the governor's initiative for, you know, welfare for out of poverty, but being able to do the jobs even as a private homeowner, I think, as I said in the beginning when we first started talking, it boils down to we're going back to basic needs. And those basic needs are things that are going to be done in America, you know, fixed in America, rebuilt in America. And I think people are wanting to realize or begin gaining the importance of, I need to learn how to do this. I need to know how to have these skills so that I can maintain.
And Blaine, I just keep thinking about, you know, the comment, just wait till the plumbing doesn't work.
That's right.
And then all of a sudden you start to find out, or when your furnace doesn't work, you find out it takes a lot to get those systems up and running and to keep them running properly. If you've ever tried to tinker with them yourself, you know it's not a small thing.
Well, that's absolutely true. It gets into the subject of training and skills and how much a person really needs to know to be successful in that chosen occupation. And there is value to those training and skills. Not everybody can be a manager or should be a manager. Matter of fact, I have worked with people that are excellent at what they do, and when they go into the management field, they for one reason or other, do not do as well as they should as a manager. But they were an excellent technician, and they provided a great service in that role.
And they are much needed. And, Mike, I wanted to ask you about our listeners' email pointed out several of the TV shows that are about blue-collar jobs. How are those shows affecting the image of manual labor types of jobs, if at all?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. They're certainly popular. And I think one reason they're popular is because because we do have, I think we have a hunger for the kind of challenge and in some cases adventure that goes with the kinds of jobs featured on these shows. Also, they're very smartly packaged. I mean, Mike Rowe's Dirty Jobs is, he actually plays up the dirty part of the dirty job.
Yes, he does.
Right? And he's a very funny guy. So I think there's an entertainment value to it as well. But I would like to think that there's something else going on. And just, you know, a word of praise for Mike Rowe, he is engaged in a very serious attempt to talk about work and labor, and he does that in addition to the show, which, of course, is, as I said, quite entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
So good for him.
Yeah, so maybe he's going to make a difference in the image and in the way we view these kinds of jobs. We have a caller on the line now. This is Patrice. Hi, Patrice. Thanks for your patience. You're on Open Line.
Yes, I had a comment about changing attitudes early. And I think part of the problem is that when children enter grade school or even preschool, whatever, the emphasis right away is on academics. And I think that if we taught more problem solving and we also taught how the tradespeople affect our lives and the information they had to know, if it started early, I think that would make it a lot easier for people to accept that that is very important in our daily lives.
Mm-hmm. And Carol, do you want to comment on what Patrice has just said?
I absolutely agree. I think from the get-go, even girls and boys are treated differently. They're geared toward different kinds of trainings in schools. I believe it's getting better. I have to believe that it's better than it used to be, but I still think we need to help people appreciate the value of the work that somebody does. For an example, if you can go to a 5-star restaurant, but if you get bad service at that restaurant, never mind whether the food's good or not, you're not going to go back. So everybody has a vital role in making everything work correctly.
And Blaine, you're sort of nodding in agreement.
Yes, I would agree with that statement. I think one of the things that happens is in the K through 12 system, there is such an emphasis on going to college, and I don't want to downplay the importance of going on and getting post-secondary education after you graduate high school, whether that be additional coursework in a technical area or a full-fledged college degree. Those are all important for people and their future. But at the same time, they need to look at what kind of careers and jobs they're going to be doing. And that should start more at the elementary level with exposure, and in the middle school level with even more exposure and career guidance. And many schools do this. Columbus City Schools does provide career orientation, career opportunities, and a lot of exposure for the children while they're learning their academic skills.
And Mike, do you agree with Patrice's assertion that we need to, instead of just emphasizing the academics, generate more emphasis on problem solving and practical skills and not look down on those kinds of things?
Well, Patrice is right. I mean, everything has to start early on. What I would say to that, though, is that the way I would like to think about this is that we would even stop making this distinction between quote-unquote academics and quote-unquote life-oriented skills or problem-solving, because, again, I think one of our problems has been that we think about these domains in such separate ways, when, in fact, we ought to see them in much more overlapping ways. And I think that that would benefit everybody, for those who are going to go on to be PhDs in physics to those who are going to be master craftsmen everybody benefits, I think, when we interweave these ways of looking in the world rather looking at the world rather than separating them.
All right, and we have Charlotte on the line now. Hi, Charlotte. Welcome to Open Line.
Welcome. Thank you for taking my call. I have a dear brother who was 16 years a Navy boiler tech. He now works at the plant department of University of North Carolina in Greensboro. I have another half-brother who maintained a jet aircraft engine on Harrier fighter planes for the Marine Corps. If you want people to go into blue collars, first of all, yes, you do have to get rid of that false distinction between academics and work that uses the hand as if manual work did not use the brain. I would trust my brothers with my life, and there are some academicians over there on the medical campus I wouldn't let trim my toenails. All right?
Okay, Charlotte.
Let's just get rid of that nonsense. Because the other thing there, too, is, for instance, in Germany, their economy of years ago was 60% dependent on exports. Do you think every one of those master mechanics, craftsmen, and line workers who ever put out a Volkswagen or a BMW or a Mercedes had a college degree? They were master craftsmen. They were paid for their work. They were respected, and they weren't taken for chumps.
Okay, Charlotte, thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate your comments a lot. Blaine?
Well, one of the things that has happened in public education over the last several years is the infusion of what we would call applied academics. And we keep bringing up the term academics, but applied academics is really the use of the math skills and writing skills to apply them to a problem, a job, a career. And those programs do exist, and they are being infused in many of the school systems throughout Ohio. And so there really is a blurring of the distinctions between the two areas.
And, Carol, you're recognizing what Blaine is talking
about.
Absolutely.
One of the other programs that we have that I'm direct is the OTEP for Youth program. And that was the reason that the program started, evolved to begin with, so that young people could get the opportunity to try it, so to speak, try it and see if you like it, get some ideas on the trades. And it's an after-school program, meets 2 days a week, and these are for 16 to 18-year-olds. They simply come in and they get introduced to the trades, plumbing, welding, electrical work, roofing, all kinds of stuff. And it's just an opportunity to see if it's something that might be interesting to them. And it's just I think it's an awesome program because it gives them that opportunity to see what all is available.
And we're almost out of time, but just very quickly, in about 30 seconds each, Mike, how are we shortchanging ourselves by not valuing our blue-collar workers more?
Well, I think in all the ways we've been talking about, we're not appreciating the work they do, but more importantly, we're not appreciating or looking forward to the ways that the work they do could be enhanced, made better, that we could, as a society, benefit more from it and from their participation.
Okay, very quickly, one quick statement on that, Blaine.
Well, I would agree with that, and I think that employees that are working out there in business and industry, as an example, they contribute an awful lot to our economy, and they should be valued more, and it's just it's important.
And you get the last word, Carol, in 15 seconds.
I just long for the time when people can do the work that they have a passion for, based on their total abilities and knowledge, and everybody can be equal.
And I sure want to thank all of my guests, Professor Mike Rose of UCLA, author of the book The Mind at Work, Blaine Waldron, Supervisor of Adult Community Education for Columbus City Schools, and this Carol Higgins from Columbus State. This has been Open Line on WOSU 820 Columbus.